This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Rodrigo Garcia, wrote and directed the new film Mother and Child, which is about adoption from several different points of view. Annette Bening plays a woman who got pregnant at the age of 14 and gave up the child for adoption. That child, who is an adult now, feels abandoned by her mother. She's played by Naomi Watts. Kerry Washington plays a woman trying to adopt a child. Garcia's work usually focuses on relationships. He directed several episodes of the first season of HBO's In Treatment about a psychiatrist and his patients. Garcia's father is the Nobel Prize-winning writer Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Let's start with a scene from Mother and Child. Kerry Washington and her husband are at a Catholic adoption agency explaining to the nun why she and her husband are ready for a child. The nun is played by Cherry Jones.
We've been married for 4 years. And we've been trying from the beginning, but we just haven't been able to. And we've been hoping, you know, against hope, as they say, but that just isn't going to be. And we've accepted that. And we're not bitter. I mean, I don't think. Do you think we're bitter about it? No, we're not. So we could be good parents. You know, Joseph is a very tender man, affectionate, and we could learn to love a baby in a minute, even if it wasn't ours. Would we get to name the baby ourselves?
It depends on the circumstances. Sometimes the biological parents and the adoptive parents agree on a name.
We could agree to agree. Well, we're ready now to adopt. I mean, blood is important, but it's the time spent together that really matters. Isn't that right?
That's a scene from Mother and Child. Rodrigo Garcia, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to center your movie on three women whose lives revolve around adoption?
My original idea was not about adoption at all. I was actually interested in people who, you know, who are separated, who for some set of circumstances, be it, you know, exile, distance, divorce, death, whatever, sort of live apart from one another and live, you know, longing for one another, a person who sort of has the ghost of an absent one in their lives. So I thought I would, you know, take a mother and child separated at the baby's birth, and that, you know, I made the mother 14 so that clearly she had not made an informed decision. It had been made for her. And the story would really start, you know, 35 years later when the women have never met and are fully grown and they are, you know, making their way in the world with that absence in their lives. You know, they're each other's ghost, as it were. And then later, you know, I introduced the character of Lucy, played in the movie by Kerry Washington, and she's a third woman who's looking to adopt a baby. And I always thought of her as also having that absent person in her life that she longs, and it's, you know, that baby that she dreams of that she's never met yet.
One of the questions that some characters ask of other characters in the movie is, do you believe in God? Why did you want to put that in?
You know, when I was doing the research about, you know, some of these adoption stories, accounts and memoirs that people wrote about, you know, it seemed to me, and again, I'm talking about the old system, what they call the closed adoption, the secret adoption, the one that was, you know, surrounded pregnancies and adoptions with shame. It seemed to me that a lot of people who had gone through the looking for someone, trying to find someone, trying to connect, felt a little bit under this sense that life had been fated. You know, if I had been given to this family or if this family had adopted me instead of this other one. You know, the stories of looking for each other were full of near misses and coincidences. You know, women who, you know, might be looking for each other out in the world, and then they would eventually find out that for 5 years, without knowing it, they had worked in the same building or, you know, lived in the same city at the same time. Fate, circumstance, a feeling of coincidence seems to hover over these stories. And, you know, it just, for me, it inspired the question, you know, is it a fluke? Is it luck? Is it the die rolling? Or is someone, you know, calling the shots? I am not a religious person, so my first instinct is not to think, you know, that there's divine intervention. But I honestly don't, you know, who pulls the strings of some of these extraordinary coincidences of people meeting or missing each other.
You mentioned that you did research. What kind of research on adoption did you do?
I only read accounts. You know, I did not read specialists. I read memoirs, diaries, interviews with people who had, you know, been separated. And I use it as an active verb because, again, I'm not talking mostly about, you know, women who were older and who made informed adult choices to say it's better for me and for this unborn baby if I, you know, put the baby up for adoption. I'm talking mostly about, you know, very young girls in the 50s, 60s, even the early 70s who, you know, were pretty much forced, first of all, to hide their pregnancy and then to give up the baby. So, the movie was never about adoption. It's not a treatise on adoption. It's not a primer on adoption. You know, it's a look at the nature of a separation, of a forced separation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer and director Rodrigo Garcia. His new movie is called Mother and Child. He also was the showrunner on In Treatment and directed and wrote many episodes. Since you've done a lot of serious television, particularly for HBO, I'm wondering if you feel cramped writing a movie compared to having like a whole season for characters to evolve.
The truth is most of the television I've done for HBO, I've directed episodes and I've directed pilots, but I haven't written them. In the case of In Treatment, I was the showrunner, which, you know, in some ways, you know, is considered the head writer. There's a writing team, but, you know, I'm the showrunner is the head writer. We were adapting the show from an extraordinary Israeli show called Betty Pool, which was just, I thought, wonderful. And I thought it could definitely translate into practically any, you know, Western country for sure. Of course, we did work. You always adapt and you always try to improve on in whatever area that you can. But, you know, that show was very good and very strong. So I have never in TV had to face the blank page completely, as it were. I think it's daunting to be a creator showrunner of a show. I don't know how, you know, the men who run, 24 or Lost or, you know, certainly Sopranos, Six Feet Under. I don't know where, you know, they have the wherewithal to come up. You know, they have writing staffs, but still hour after hour. I mean, that's something that I feel, you know, could crush me.
In adapting the Israeli TV series into the HBO series In Treatment, can you think of an example of something that didn't translate from the Israel version to the American version?
You know, I think in some ways we did not soften any of the conflicts. You know, we left the conflicts as they were, and wherever we could up the conflict, we did. Perhaps, and, you know, I'm saying this with a bit of a chuckle because I think people who've seen both series recognize it. There is a more direct way of dealing that the Israeli doctor and patient have with each other. You know, there is a way of talking to each other that I think by American standards would just be very brash. But I think, I think Israelis, at least in my experience with Israeli friends and Israeli acquaintances, you know, they're very comfortable talking very directly to each other. And I think, you know, in the U.S., people are more circumspect or more polite or, you know, more, you know, they want to sort of sometimes beat around the bush, whereas even in therapy, you know, whereas the Israeli characters really went at each other. So we did have to change, I think, the tone of how people spoke to each other. And that's just a cultural thing. You know, it was still therapy. Whether you're talking directly or indirectly, you know, the Israeli characters, like the American characters, were often lying to themselves also.
My favorite storyline in In Treatment is the storyline between the therapist, played by Gabriel Byrne, and his therapist, played by Diane Weiss. So I thought I'd play a clip from an episode that you developed and directed from season one. And in this episode, Paul, the therapist played by Gabriel Byrne, he's had an infatuation, really, with one of his patients who's been very flirtatious with him, even to the point of, like, describing in great detail, kind of pornographically, sexual encounters she's had with men. She's also had an affair with one of his other patients, as if to try to create jealousy on the therapist's part. So the therapist really wants to have an affair with her. He wants to sleep with her. But he knows that his therapist will say that that's wrong. So here's a scene between Paul and his therapist, who's played by Diane Wiest.
I know you think it's a problem that I have this jealousy over Laura's affair with Alex.
No, not necessarily.
Jealousy is not on your list of reactions a therapist should have, or is it a list of no-no feelings?
Is that what you want from me, a list? Would that make it easier?
I doubt it.
Oh, you keep putting words in my mouth. Maybe you want me to be unreasonable so you have something to push against.
This topic always brings us back onto shaky ground, doesn't it?
What topic?
The boundaries between therapist and patient. Teachers marry students. There's no big deal about it. Is it really wrong?
It's different, Paul.
I remember Charlie, your patient. He used to call me after sessions and he'd say, "It's no sex with the therapist thing. It's driving me crazy. Is it for real? There's got to be a loophole. Am I never going to get to sleep with Gina?" Okay, let's say I stop Laura's therapy. Let's say I send her to somebody else, as you want me to do. Surely in 6 months' time, I can call her up and say...
No. No, you can't.
All right, then a year, 18
no,
months,
Paul,
when it's cooled
no,
off.
There's no cooling off period. It's not about cooling off. It doesn't change the dynamic. In 6 months or 10 years, she'll still be a patient.
But that's just some lawyer came up with.
No, it's not a law. It's beyond a code of ethics. It's essential. It's something you carry inside you. Can't you see that?
So what you're saying is that there is no conceivable set of circumstances in
none.
Which... Christ, you're so fundamentalist. You know, there's a lot of people who would disagree with this.
Then go to them.
That's Diane Wiest and Gabriel Byrne in a scene from season one of In Treatment, and that episode was directed and developed by my guest Rodrigo Garcia. Watching this series, I always wondered, how could Paul, the therapist, be such a really good therapist most of the time, but be such like a really petulant patient, like a really irritating patient?
It's worth clarifying that, you know, part of the problem is the relationship between Paul, played by Gabriel Byrne, and the character Gina, played by Diane Wiest, is that the nature of their relationship is very messy. You know, she calls him on it more than once. Are you here as a patient, or do you want me to be your supervisor? Are you asking my opinion as a colleague? Are you asking my opinion as a friend? That's why their discussions, like the one we just heard, get so messy. You know, and it doesn't sound like patient therapist, because they keep it messy. You know, they
and
get
she,
themselves...
she used to supervise him when he was studying.
Yes, she used to supervise him, and also, you know, he was her protege back when. They've gone into this, and it's messy, and I think he keeps it messy. I think he keeps it messy to try to gain the advantage and try to get her to agree with him in these very dicey propositions that he's making. But, you know, fine actors. I have to say, I had not heard this exchange for a long time, maybe a couple of years. And they are so, you know, well suited to each other.
Oh, they're
and
great
they're just,
together.
They're
yeah.
just, it's a great dynamic, and no one lets anyone off the hook.
You know, Diane Wiest, she was really a revelation to me in this. You know, I've seen her in movies, but I've never seen her be so kind of self-contained. Like, there's so much that she is very still physically. She's just always sitting in the chair, very, very still and calm. And you could see all these things flickering on her face, like sadness, grief, anger, but it's all very contained. You know,
a lot is made in TV and movies of dialogue, and you know, great dialogue is great, and it can be fun and snappy and provocative. But you know what great actors do, which is great, and what movies do, and TV, and it's intoxicating, is not, you know, people talking, but people listening, you know, people reacting. And an actor like Diane, you know, it's you can see the thought, you know, on her face and eyelids and the twitch of a cheek. I mean, it's like this pool of intelligence, emotion, insight.
Now, Warren Light, who was, I think, one of the chief writers on the series, was quoted as saying one of the qualifications to write for the series was to have been in therapy. Did you already have that on your resume?
I did have it. I was the showrunner the first year, and Warren was the showrunner the second year. So we didn't really overlap. But yes, I had that. I mean, I'm not a lifer, but I had I had some good experience with it. Yes.
Well, now, was that helpful to writing the show, or were the characters in the show so different, and were the confrontations so much more theatrical that your experience didn't quite apply?
Well, it all applies, and it's funny how much of therapy overlaps with drama. You know, the patients want something. Sometimes they know what it is. Sometimes they don't. They come to therapy looking for it. Sometimes they won't admit that they're looking for it. Sometimes they come to therapy to talk about one subject, and once they're there, they avoid talking about it for days, months, sometimes years, sometimes a lifetime. There were just some dramatic choices that the original creators made that really, I think, were genius regarding the show. First of all, you know, to center the show around the shrink's own crisis. Of course, the patients have to work, and they were very engaging, and, you know, they all had to work individually. But at the center of the show is the doctor's own crisis. And of course, seeing him with his sessions with his own supervisor, you know, helped you get to know him better. But yes, I mean, everything, you know, you draw from everything, and your own experience lying to yourself in therapy is very useful.
Now, in addition to working on In Treatment for HBO, you directed episodes of 6 Feet Under, the pilot of Big Love, and episode of The Sopranos. Do they all have different styles? Did you have to learn different styles for each of those shows?
They do have different styles, and I learned their own styles from those shows. You know, I think Big Love is a little different because I did the pilot, and I think in the pilot you work with the creators of the show, the people who wrote the pilot. Mark Olson and Will Sheffer in particular wrote Big Love, and it was just a very good script. You know, I worked with them to, you know, bring the pilot together and create a tone for the pilot and a mood for it, etc. That's different from visiting an episodic show like I did on Sopranos or 6 Feet Under. It's great fun, and it can be done well, and I truly enjoy it, but, you know, I don't want to come in and reinvent anything. You know, I try to watch as many episodes as I can of a series when I'm first on it. If I can, I watch every episode of the series in order so that I'm really soaked in it, and that I learned that tone from the series, and I go in and I work in that key, as it were. You know, I'm not coming in to reinvent. I still want to contribute, do it well, look at performance, try to, you know, give the scenes a spark, make it vivid and juicy, but I'm working in the key of Sopranos, in the key of 6 Feet Under.
Your father is the novelist Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's best known for his books 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera. He won a Nobel Prize for Literature in 1982. So he wrote screenplays in addition to novels. When you were growing up, did you think that writing novels were any more important than screenplays from watching your father work?
No. I mean, it was all storytelling. You know, I grew up in that environment where, you know, storytelling was always in the foreground, you know. All of my parents' friends were, you know, writers, poets, screenwriters, painters, some actors, some playwrights. It was all equally good, you know, everything from telling a good joke well to writing a novel, it was all highly regarded. And when I was a kid, my father not only wrote, but he would also write screenplays, usually co-write them, often with directors. So, you know, him sitting in the living room hashing out a story with a director was, you know, also part of our childhood.
Did he talk about writing a lot, and did you pick up things about writing just from conversations?
Yeah, he was always talking to other writers, and, you know, I never thought that I was going to be a director, much less a screenwriter. I always was interested more in images, in being a still photographer or in camera work. When I sat down to write what became my first movie, my first screenplay, it was hard to write. But, you know, I had picked up, you know, on some of the way you know, writers write and rewrite, and where inspiration might come from, and how you develop inspiration into an idea and an idea into something dramatized, into a story. So I did have, you know, a sort of a knowledge of what the bones of what it is, you know, what you need to do to write.
Now, your father was famous for magical realism, where, you know, magical or surreal things are happening in otherwise realistic settings. You write very intimate stories where the plot revolves around your characters' relationships and their emotional lives. Do you see yourself as working in some ways in opposition to your father's work?
You know, I work for, you know, I write the script that comes out of me. You know, I don't think, you know, is this like him? Is this not like him? You know, I grew up in a world very different from his. I mean, we grew up in the same household, but he as a kid grew up in 1920s and 30s small town in Colombia, a small town that had seen better days, you know, where he heard stories, you know, from his great uncles and great aunts and grandparents. You know, I had a upbringing in Mexico City as a, you know, middle-class kid with money who traveled, and you know, it's such a different upbringing that you know, I chose something that is an expression of what I've seen and what I've heard, you know. And in some ways it's not by design, but I'm glad we work in very different worlds, you know. That way I haven't had to suffer the comparison, at least of the worlds.
So you were born in Colombia, but you grew up in Mexico City. Did you see a lot of TV and movies growing up in Mexico City, and were many of them American?
I did watch, you know, more TV than I should have, I think. You know, I think back then there was less concern with how many hours of TV we watched. A lot of the shows were American. You know, I did as a kid watch, you know, dubbed into Spanish, everything from you know, the Flintstones to the Addams Family to Mr. Ed, the Brady Bunch, La Familia Brady, but also movies. I mean, I was not a movie geek by any standard, but you know, in my teens already, my father's own taste in film started, you know, trickling down to my brother and I, and you know, he was a big fan of Truffaut in particular, and of Kurosawa. So, you know, those were directors that we were, you know, very familiar with.
When you were growing up in Mexico, did you watch any of those Mexican vampire movies?
Of course, and the vampire movies and the wrestling movies, and often the wrestling movies with vampires in them.
Oh, I haven't seen any of those.
Oh, the combination is endless, believe me, and maybe a Frankenstein monster somewhere in the back.
So did you watch them for fun when you were older, or just like when you were younger?
Yeah, no, just as a kid. It's not really my genre, except of course, you know, sometimes there are excellent examples of that genre, but mostly, you know, I've always been a fan of, you know, the kind of movie that I like to make, you know, that I try to make, which is, you know, the contemporary, you know, realistic psychological movie.
Now, there was a period when I think your father was considered subversive by the United States, and he was denied a visa to the United States. And I'm wondering what impact that had on you.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, we grew up in a world, of course, in the 60s and 70s, you know, my parents were left-wing, and they were openly left-wing. So, of course, you know, the role of the U.S. in Vietnam, in Chile, in Argentina, and, you know, the training of death squads for Central America. I mean, that was considered, of course, the enemy. On the other hand, you know, my father had great American friends and a great love and admiration for the U.S., and he always said that his biggest regret was not being fluent in English so that he could, you know the country better. And, of course, you know, writers like Hemingway and Faulkner had been really, you know, instrumental in making, to some extent, the writer that he was. So, yeah, so I found myself in a situation where I was in college here in the U.S. in a country where my father could hardly get a visa to visit, except maybe like a one-time entry or something like that.
So another question about your father. Have you ever used him as a first reader, or would you prefer he be more of a last reader?
You know, he's someone who reads my scripts when I'm, you know, in early pre-production. And he's always been very supportive. In fact, he's an easy reader. In that sense, he's not an ideal reader for feedback because he's quick to be supportive. And he, you know, he's very high on my films and my television work and shows it off to his friends shamelessly.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Rodrigo Garcia wrote and directed the new film Mother and Child. You can watch clips from the film on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for digital media. Roberta Schirach directs the show. I'm Tariq Rose.